Hello, Doodle Bitches. Welcome to another rip-roaring episode of Art and Labor, the podcast dedicated to the ongoing struggle to survive as an art and or cultural worker. I am Lucia Love.
And I'm OK Fox.
And we're joined by a very, 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 very special guest. I say that about all my favorite people that I have been following. I'm like, this one's the most very special. If you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Zachary Small. I'm a senior writer at Hyperallergic.
Cool. Yeah, I'm so grateful that you would join us here because throughout all of the museum protests and like questions about accountability and like every time there was something about Warren Canders or every time there was something about like the biennial or just sort of like labor issues in general that were going through Hyperallergic, I saw your name pop up, and then just to be able to speak with you and hear more about your upcoming stories that you're working on and that are coming out soon. Like, I'm just thrilled, and like, thank you for doing the work that you've been doing. It's awesome.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Yeah,
it's super exciting to have you here. Like, your pieces in Hyperallergic throughout, like the like there's just so many, like there's always we've referenced multiple on our show in the past, and I always put together the show notes and I'm often linking to your articles about
like, it's really a team effort though. For real, it's a small team, but of course we're working all the time to try and shed light on these issues, with which before Hyperallergic started, not a lot of publications. Not any publications really we're covering. So yeah. It's been cool to see the industry shift and, dare I say, follow our lead on some of this.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think we were talking a little bit the other day off mic about how how the reception for like art world journalism is in the wider sphere of news and goings on, and I don't know. I'm interested to hear more about your take on working in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's changed so much even since I started almost 5 years ago. In terms of just what is expected from arts journalists, how the rest of the field, the rest of media really reacts with art stories. When I started, like most people that are arts journalists, I started as an art critic. You kind of gain those chops for being really, really subjective and trying to come away with a grander message about art. And then I think a lot of people like myself then transition to stuff that requires relatively objective reporting and looking for the facts in stories. So there's sort of a funny movement away from the subjective to fact-based reporting, which I really like. And that's what I'm getting into in terms of investigations with the Whitney, of course, other things we have working on right now, some that are coming up fairly soon, actually, which should be out when this podcast airs, I believe.
Yeah. So, I mean, we should say, so you have a 5-part series about art handlers. It's coming out while we are recording right now, but it will be out when you guys are hearing it right now. So
yes.
That's why we're speaking in these terms.
Yeah. Right. And I'm very excited to share it with everyone. It's 10,000 words about basically the field of art handling across the country. I've spoken to dozens of art handlers, different people involved in the industry as well, to get a sense of where things are. I felt like when we were covering the Whitney, Warren Canders, and the Board of Trustees controversies, honestly, around the art world, in separate countries as well, we spend a lot of time in arts journalism focused on the big players and the money. There's a whole cottage industry of magazines devoted to covering auctions because that's where all the money is.
Yeah.
And art fairs. Don't forget, right. Freeze magazine is part of the Freeze Art Fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, those funding streams are an important part of figuring out why a publication is covering what they cover. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to do was kind of take a step back and say, okay, we've looked at the top now. Let's look at the bottom. Let's look at the manual labor involved in creating art fairs and museums and galleries and auction houses, and let's see how they're actually being treated. I think in terms of my own work, what I usually follow is the big lie. And the big lie of the art world is that it is a microcosm of the real world where we are treating people better, more equitably. But often what I find in my reporting is that's not the truth, and that's not the full case.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like that NPR grand narrative where everyone's like, actually, the world is definitely better by these metrics that we've invented for ourselves that say that, you know, even though there's been a war going on X amount of continents for X amount of years, there's actually less war somehow, even though we're just constantly in some kind of a violent altercation. There's less violence, but we can put numbers to this, and things are progressively getting more bougie.
Steven Pinker told me that
that he had a great time hanging out with Epstein.
But right, so there is the whole system will enable a someone like Epstein, or you know, people who collect art, are art collectors who are also like abusive billionaire scumbags, and so it's good to examine all the points of what builds up.
And what you often get with a case like the Whitney Museum, where there's, you know, Warren Kanders, who owns many companies, we have since found out, which manufacture weapons and tear gas, ammunitions used everywhere from Gaza to the U.S.-Mexico border to Ferguson. We find that museums or the establishment, whatever that really means, but older professionals in this industry, they ask, well, are we going to have an art world if we don't have these people? You know, they're bringing in a lot of money. Mm-hmm. We need money to create this system. And what that says to me, and maybe it's because I'm younger than them, maybe it's because of the reporting or whatever, it could be a million things.
You got a real idealistic streak in you, kid.
I don't know about that. No. I feel pretty jaded. Yeah. But what it signals to me when I hear those sort of comments is, ironically, a lack of imagination and a lack of creativity in the art world, where we can't imagine a way forward, where we don't have quote-unquote toxic philanthropy, where we can't create visions of museums that aren't reliant on money that comes from essentially killing people.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's kind of a false dichotomy. I was just talking with someone from another publication just about the field and about my work. And one of the things that I still really want to do that's been on the back burner is just talk to people in development at museums. You know, we keep talking about trustees and money and money and, oh, well, you know, there's a necessary evil here. Development, a big part of their role is to bring in new money. So if they can't replace one donor, I don't know what that system is supposed to be doing, really, other than keeping the ones that are there already happy.
Well, I think that once you start to dissect the sort of like moral foundations of the extremely wealthy, we start to see that even in the most progressive foundations, there's always like a weird history of violence or infraction, or there's always like a point at which, you know, there's a lot of problematic kind of inequality baked into every possible donor on a spectrum.
Right. Well, my theory comes back to this big lie. I feel like this would be less salacious and less dramatic if there was full disclosure of where these trustees are getting their money from and how it's affecting what's being put on the museum. I mean, we know from MoMA, board members have stepped down because they're advocating for exhibitions for artists in their own collections, which, you know, means that they would get a boost in price at auction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not something that MoMA wants on its board. That's someone that has to step down from the board and has. But of course, we know that that's likely happening more than, you know, we hear of course.
Sure. And then there's still people like Leon Black who are allowed to hold court in the MoMA board that, you know,
right.
has they have untold amounts of scandals that I'm sure will hopefully also be unrolled. I mean, yeah, keep the entertainment going.
I mean, we have two things I wanted to mention was the DIRT, the decolonial or deinstitutional research team, mm-hmm. who have been like researching the different board members, yep. and I think following a lot of your work and you know, not just Warren Canders, but like all of these board members, like and all of these executives, mm-hmm. which is like really key for a lot of this stuff. And the other thing I wanted to bring up was like the idea of like it like insider trading within the board or whatever mm-hmm. is impossible to regulate because so you can get one person out for having a direct line to a show, but like what's stopping them from like talking like getting one for their friend and like there's no
I think it's more possible to regulate than we think though. It's a very small pool of people. They all know each other. Mm. I mean, I think that's clear from the reporting on the quote unquote toxic philanthropy that we see these connections between a small group of people and they're all in the museums. You know, what's bringing Betsy DeVos's sister-in-law onto the Whitney board?
Yeah.
You know, these people are associating with each other. And I guess, you know, the scrutiny is making it hard for them to maintain their social contacts in a way. And that's mm-hmm. where a lot of anger comes from the board. You know, famously, or infamously now, Ken Griffith resigned from the Whitney board and then actually... didn't resign, and the story kept changing right on the page of the New York Times because of that sort of interchange of like, well, what is this status symbol worth? Is it worth me being investigated by these tiny art magazines and being blasted in the public eye? Do I really need this? Is philanthropy enough? So that becomes its own issue. But I think in addressing your question, actually monitoring the connection between exhibitions and how they profit board members is something that we could do better at for sure. I think the question then also has to be, is that a bad thing, right? It again comes back to like, well, if these people are investing their money and it is an investment to be on a board in many ways.
Will they keep doing it?
Will they keep doing it? Should they be allowed to recoup some investment? I don't think those questions are crazy, but they should be asked.
Well, yeah, because it if you did stand the chance to make it into a position that mm-hmm. was something like a directorship or there was some kind of, you know, a financial model that works mm-hmm. for accepting people of perhaps like lesser status, instead of it being these billionaires who are war profiteers, maybe there are people who just have art collections, really like art, have, you know, there are people that... I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're a little more low profile and it's more of like a harm reduction route, but I could easily see this model ending up as sort of like capped off and broadened. Mm. And like maybe add some workers on the board.
Yeah. Well, yeah, what do you think of the idea of like workers on the board or having some sort of public accountability to boards?
I mean, they should have public accountability, especially because I mean, if you're a nonprofit, you're getting tax breaks from the city. A lot of museums are also directly getting grants from the city. So there are actually certain mechanisms, especially in New York, where these museums have to report certain diversity statistics, one of which quite recently actually was about board member makeup. And, you know, in terms of race, in terms of, I believe money was on there as well. Gender, definitely. Maybe money wasn't on there, but it should have been. Yeah, I mean, workers should be on the board. Public accountability is a thing. It's just that I think the media hasn't been as good as publicizing those reports when they come out. And the city also hasn't been very good at publicizing them when they come out. Mm. I think that's part of the problem is transparency in the whole system. In terms of getting workers and artists on the board, you do see that. I think it's at LACMA, right? LACMA has like Catherine Opie on the board and a bunch of artists. So
there's so many. Yeah, LACMA had that whole the whole scandal of like the when Jeffrey Deitch went over and all of the artists on the board ended up quitting and protesting. And that is one of the moves that like a more invested group of people could do to like maintain some sort of, I don't know, integrity? Mm-hmm. I don't know, like, where we define integrity when everything is sort of open to the entertainment value perceived by whoever is constructing mm-hmm. the kind of
right.
experience. But
I think that a museum, most established museums, are inclined not to do that and not to invite workers on the board because of the makeup of the board that exists, right? It's kind of a never-ending cycle in terms of the money. I mean, the board is really there for the money. So for them, they would probably come back and say, well, what is the worker going to offer us? You know, are they going to finance an exhibition? Mm-hmm. How are they going to do that? And so those are the questions that you would probably be confronted with if you asked a museum that question.
Yeah, I would hope that that's something people could somehow, like, safeguard against, where it's like, well, no, there are workers on the board because they have a say as to what goes on in their communities, and everyone is working to make this institution fortified and exciting. And, I don't know why you wouldn't want their opinions, at least. Right. Like,
well, what you're getting to is because workers in the art industry are constantly undervalued for what their labor is.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's good that so many of these museums are unionizing, because then it's like, okay, then you advocate for workers on the board, and then it's a direct line the union has into, like, what goes on with their workers' lives directly, you know, to have a say with, you know, say the show is very physically demanding or in some way or something like that, or requires a lot of overtime or something like that. Like, these are things that they should be privy to from the beginning. And that I guess that leads us to, like, art handlers, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what type of art handlers did you speak to for your piece? Did you just all over, right? Did you talk to the art handlers union?
Yeah, several. Several art handler unions. The Art Handler Alliance of New York. Which is not a union, though.
They're not a union. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they're specifically not a union because they want to be able to, as they've said to me, kind of negotiate on both sides of the table and be able to sort of exchange information on executive levels and worker levels. So that's kind of where they are. It's very interesting to think about them in terms of another group you might have discussed on the podcast, Wage.
Oh, yeah.
Which functions similarly for artists in that they are not a union, but they try to collectively bargain for artists and also exchange information and increase transparency for what artists are paid across the board. But yeah, so with art handlers, I've talked to these organizations. I've talked to many, many art handlers, dozens and dozens individually, to get a sense of what it's like to do that work, what people are paid. I've asked very specifically benefits. And it turns out most people are not paid much for the work that they're doing. And most don't get benefits. And most have been injured in some way or form. So it's been very eye-opening for me. It's kind of one of those moments as a reporter, you go in with an inkling and the story ends up being so much bigger than you ever thought.
Wow. That, yeah.
Yeah. It just reminds me of something. I was poking around into the construction of what the art handler's position has come to be. Like, so the making of this position is really interesting, because it started out very kind of diffuse, right? It was just like, hey, can you, like, you know about materials and stuff. Can you tell me, like, what is this surface made of? How do we fix it up? Is it weird if we package it in these kind of materials? Are they going to have some kind of a chemical reaction with each other?
If it's a large glass and we put it on a train, will it fall over?
Yes.
And then have to be put back together.
Oh, but it's even older than that.
Yeah.
The first art handling.
No, I know.
But really, like, the first art handling companies started centuries ago, literally in Italy. Of course, Italy. Renaissance, why not?
Drag that marble.
But truly, it was about dragging marble. Yeah. And we've kind of gone full circle from these heavy, huge statues at that time, where now people are saying, well, how am I going to install this Richard Serra in my loft?
Right.
And nobody has an answer, because actually an art handler is many things and can be many people, including an engineer.
So yes, absolutely.
If you're going to install a Richard Serra, you're going to need an engineer. Otherwise, they fall down, which they have. And it, you know, it's one Richard Serra going up, I believe, at the... I don't want to say this wrong. At an institution, killed an art handler who was installing it.
Yeah, that's fit. Yeah.
And another one maimed an art handler, a separate one in a separate instance.
Very, very.
And it's not just Richard Serra, you know, Calder, Mobiles.
Tony Smith.
Yep. Oh, yeah. We could just go on and on and name artworks that have killed people, and not just people, manual laborers.
Mm-hmm.
Set up to install these. And when art handlers I speak to talk about their injuries, you know, a lot of them, the vast, vast majority, don't have health insurance, have no benefits, are either, you know, contractors. Well, they've signed contract agreements. Right, right. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are actually contractors, which is something everyone should know.
Oh, yeah.
Just because you sign a contract does not legally mean you are an independent contractor. You could still be a part-time employee or a full-time employee. It's up to labor courts to decide.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. PSA.
No, that's a really good PSA. We've talked about this on the show because that's what I did at Artform. Mm-hmm. So, some listeners might already have heard this story, but I was on an illegal 1099 at Artform when I was packing their issues for them, which was totally illegal because I could not set my own hours, nor could I set my own rate.
Welcome to the party.
Yeah. Yeah. which is when I was younger, I actually reached out to the Art Handlers Alliance because I was like, do you guys encounter this? Am I supposed to be on a 1099? What is this? And that really helped me years and years ago, like DMing them on Facebook.
But people don't even, that's good. Use your Google. But people don't know about that. People
don't know
what OSHA is, which is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They're specifically set up to protect workers, especially in manual labor positions, especially in construction positions, which, of course, art handlers are kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, especially if you're doing any sort of construction work, I guess. But people don't know that. So out of all the art handlers I talked to, again, dozens and dozens, only one person contacted OSHA with a violation complaint.
Oh, of course. But I think that also that sort of the mentality stems from the way that the position is created.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something to note is like the way that we have large scale construction in general, it's like, oh, art handlers built the pyramids, basically, right? Like, and who cares? And then they were like dumped in the sand afterwards, like, whatever. Like, but now we have a more codified work environment where I found this sort of.
Do we?
Well, here's the thing. We have now constructed in 1994 was a list of conservators, preparators, and art handlers rules for the job, basically. And it's 30 points about like what a conservator, preparator, handler is supposed to be, what you were supposed to look for and cater to. And in all of these 30 points, none of them have anything to do with personal safety or like valuing yourself as a worker or like, you know, building that sort of attitude for yourself as a thing that needs to be protected while you're on the job. Right. They have like a whole clause that says like, in the case of emergency, just make sure that conservation comes first.
Well, when I talk to art handlers along those lines, conservation coming first, the art coming first, when they've been in these traumatic accidents, and one art handler, for instance, was required to move all of these books, and the gallerists, people working at the gallery, had moved the books all into this freight elevator, and so he goes in, and then the elevator plummets 6 floors because it has too much weight in it.
Oh my God!
It plummets to the ground. Miraculously, he's okay. Someone else in the elevator broke their collarbone and injured their ankle. Like, thankfully, nobody died falling flights. When it got back up and told the other gallery people what happened, the first question they asked was the art okay?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God.
And this is, he's not the only person to tell me this. This is a repeated thing where everyone wants to know, well, is the art okay? And, you know, art handlers often joke about, like, well, would you, like, fall onto the ground to save a falling vase? Or, like, how, like, what would you do? Mm-hmm. You know, would you run into the fire? And what that signals, what art handlers say, who have been through the, you know, have been on the other side of things now, of an injury, what that signals to them is that their lives aren't valued more than an object.
Right. Yeah, it reminds me of, like, the Ai Weiwei piece when he was breaking all of those, like, Ming vases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to be like, yeah, I don't, you know what? There's a lot of terrible things happening here. Can everyone just pay attention? Tiananmen Square happened. It really did. Smash, smash. these are vases.
Yeah, these
those are
ancient
people.
Objects. Like, these are actual people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Right. And it... You know, I think it's tragic because art handlers predominantly get into this field because they love art. Most of them have been to art school. Mm-hmm. Many of them have MFAs from really prestigious schools.
Totally.
And again, it comes back to the big lie that A, anyone can make it in America. B, anyone can make it in the art world.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that's not even true, even if you went to Yale.
Wait, are you calling the American dream the big lie?
It is the big lie,
yeah.
But it's also...
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
Record scratch.
But it's more than the American dream. Yeah. It's the idea of American exceptionalism and cultural exceptionalism. That's why, you know, you talked about regulations and, like, these lists. And I've seen them. The Art Handlers Alliance of New York also has a list of, like, what art handlers should do and safety precautions. That's great to make a list. Who's actually enacted that list? What museum has taken that list and actually put it into their bylaws?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What
about
you know, municipal codes? New York hasn't taken that up.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we've had this critique of wage too, like where they have a certification process, and I guess a couple of museums have done it, but then there's no body to hold that accountable or to even like to get more on board or like to get, you know, like yeah, to get it enacted properly in all forms of institutions.
Well, it's difficult and near impossible because you need the institution to enact it. I mean, you can also look at these huge alliances and like in lobbying interest groups, basically like the, you know, museum alliances. There's many of them, and they're like International Museum Alliance. ICOM is one. Don't ask me what all the abbreviations stand for. There's like four different museum alliances, but none of them really tackle, you know, standards for art handlers. Few of them, to your comment, tackle what artists should be paid for their work or if there should be a standard payment for artists for exhibitions. And that's U.S. based.
Yeah.
Canada has it's called a fee schedule for artists. Sweden has one. The U.K. has a system. The U.S. is really it's not one of the few countries. There's many, many countries that don't have this. But the U.S. is one of those countries that has not sufficiently protected arts workers. The art industry is one of the last unregulated systems that we have.
Yeah. It's actually, you know, I keep thinking back to what attracted me to the art world to begin with. And there was this sense of I have a tattoo of a pirate on my back.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause when I was in high school, I thought that was like cool.
It is cool. What do you mean?
It's still cool.
No, pirates are the best.
But now I'm like, dang, you know, it's rough living like a pirate. I get why they have eye patches and stuff, because you don't just get a glass eye from your insurance or like, you know, you don't get surgery. You just kind of get a like peg leg and then you're done.
You get scurvy all the time because not enough food and nutrition.
And it's just funny how many people were able to get into the system on that sense that, like, deregulation is exhilarating instead of, like, detrimental to your health and, like, something that you don't really need to have a good time.
Yeah.
Right.
And on that line, too, a lot of it is, like people, the reason why people don't speak out, like, you know, because even when I reached out to the Art Handlers Alliance, I didn't do anything about it. I knew I could contact the Department of Labor and be like, what's the deal here? But I didn't, because I knew that if they were busted, people would lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
for different reasons. One, maybe they're undocumented and just doing it under the table. And two, like, because
if... Did they have undocumented workers at...
In different ways, who knows? I'm just saying in general, like, there's a lot of reasons why people don't have, you know, things to prove who they are. They don't have IDs, for example. Like, I'm thinking of my friend who was trans and didn't have an ID at the time.
Oh, sure.
And, details. You know, these sort of things, like, why, like, if I were to try to get a more legitimate W-2, it could affect other people's jobs. Mm-hmm. Like, if they were to pay us more, somebody's job would have to get cut or something.
But that's, you know, that's not really true.
I know it's not really true, but, like, that's
what we're
why.
Meant to believe.
I know. Yeah.
But, you know, there's a couple things I'd say to that, having worked on this story and talked to a lot of people that have faced that. I myself, you know, we all have had jobs one time or another, sometimes bad jobs. And these questions always come up. They come up for every worker in America, for sure. The difference is in the art world, oftentimes you don't have an HR, do you? most galleries, unless you're like high blue chip, don't have HR. Even when they do, it's one person. So that's an issue in itself. But set that aside. If you're reporting something to OSHA, one of the issues you could come across is that OSHA doesn't necessarily... You can anonymously report. That's fine. OSHA, if you anonymously report... They don't always have to go and inspect. In one case that we talk about, this worker reported a gallery and OSHA called up the gallery and said, hey, we have a list of these complaints. They look like violations. Can you make sure to fix those? And so then what the gallery did, they had a week to fix things. And then all they had to do is kind of call back OSHA, which is the Department of Labor, and say, hey, we fixed it, like, everything's good. Sometimes they'll send pictures or something. Of course, that doesn't mean the problem's solved. Things, as in this case, what the employee said was that it relapsed immediately. Things went back. Right. People weren't getting paid overtime. Art handlers often don't get paid overtime. Art workers don't get paid overtime, even though, you know, you're supposed to.
The issue of anonymously reporting, too, if, say, you're, like, a team of three, and you anonymously report. Then it's like, it doesn't really protect you.
Yeah.
Oh, but actually legally it does. Legally it does protect you, because if you anonymously reported something and then someone fired you, there are whistleblower protections in OSHA, but in worker laws in general. New York, for all of its problems, is one of the most worker-friendly places in America. If they did that, they would be fined up to and around $20,000 for every infraction. And so that could be intimidation, you know, undue firing, all these different sorts of things. Those will rack up in employers. Ooh. But that's not to say that the employers know that they could be responsible.
But this is making me feel powerful.
People,
you
are powerful.
Like, I could just out and out have a fight with these folks
and
if
they're
not treating
but
me right.
But here's the thing. If you work in corporate America, there are so many safeties to what you can and can't do in the office. You can't just be summarily fired for something. Most places have like 6-month plans where they try and get you back on track, or they try and figure it out. They have HR systems that are trying to make sure that, you know, you are happy, the aggrieved party is happy, and that it's figured out. Because firing an employee in most industries and rehiring an employee is super expensive. But in the art world, what you see, because there's such a high demand, employers think that they can get away with it. But yeah, legally, not
so much. I mean, they often do get away with it.
They do, because of the silence.
Because of the culture of silence. Mm-hmm. But I will say, happy ending for like the art form packer workers is like OSHA, like the Department of Labor did audit them. It wasn't even me. Like I think everybody probably thinks it was me. It
on
really
the record,
wasn't me.
Folks, someone else was having a bad time in hell too.
And they were audited, and then they did switch everyone to W-2s, which did fuck over the one friend who didn't have ID stuff together. And if there was a better HR, they did have an HR, but the HR was also the business manager of the magazine.
Right.
So maybe if they had a better HR structure, they could have worked with my friend a bit more to help her get her documents in order. But
Well, I think what I would say to that is, of course, your friend was working there for a long time, and there's proof of them working there. So in terms of firing, like they're kind of separate issues. And yeah. I'm full disclosure, I'm not a lawyer.
No, yeah. Sorry to get into the nitty gritty.
No, no, just, it's fine. Like
I figured I'd tell the story to the end.
I love labor laws; they're great. But I think that you would run into a case where those are two separate things, where like they probably would have to figure out something with back pay in terms of the taxes that your friend was required to pay for a 1099 when the company should have been paying them. And then also try to figure out, you know, how do we keep this person on? Because then what is the cause for firing?
Yeah, I think everybody should look into just that, the history of employment, and look at times you were on illegal 1099s mm-hmm.
And overtime, of course, is like a
case.
Build a case.
Build a case.
Yeah, but back to art handlers, you know, if we're talking about just being employed, don't forget about benefits. Benefits are yes. so important to people. Art handlers, by and large, aren't getting them. So the story that opens our 10,000-word art handler piece is an art handler in New Orleans, and he was working at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, which is a very respected institution in New Orleans, and they had him installing this community show, actually, and there's like a movable wall, like a partition not really part of his job, but they're like, hey, can you actually move that? He was like, I don't know. Is it safe? Like the wheel seems a little wobbly. They're like, yeah, go ahead, do it. The wall falls on him and hits him with the force of essentially a grand piano.
Oh my
God. It's about like 800 pounds, 800, 1,000 pound wall. Just crushes him, twists his leg back. He has a punctured lung. All of these issues you can't even imagine, just broken bones everywhere. And as he alleges, as he was being rushed to the hospital in the ambulance, the museum changed his employment status. This is the other way around, though. They changed his employment status from a contract worker to a part-time employee. So what that did was that gave him access to workers' compensation. It's not health insurance, but it's a form of insurance that every company is supposed to have in order to pay for injuries. So in a way they helped him because that he would get his hospital bills covered. Mm. But in a way it also hurt him because he couldn't sue them for negligence, which might have actually been a bigger payout. Mm. And of course, workers' comp, yes, it'll cover, usually, sometimes, will cover health fees, hospital bills, but it's not going to replace the lost wages of this person. His monthly checks were $300 a week. So that's not going to cover rent, food, anything.
No.
And what happens then, you know, art handlers, you got to be a jack of all trades, but also it's a very specific skill set. He might not have wanted to go back to art handling after this super traumatic event, but in the end, after a full year of recovering from this accident, he had to go back to art handling because he is tens of thousands of dollars in debt.
That's disgusting.
So yeah. There are a lot of these stories where questions of labor laws, of benefits, of, do I speak out? Do I not? What about an OSHA issue? All of this, you know, really comes to a fore when you're talking about manual labor, especially in the art world, where, again, there's this idea of exceptionalism, that we're doing this high culture thing. So we don't have to worry about these little details, right? And a lot of institutions, you know, most curators aren't trained to be managers. Most people at museums aren't trained to have management positions. And so you get a flouting of a lot of these laws or protections and not a lot of infrastructure to let people know that there are ways that they can, you know, get a better deal for themselves or protect themselves. A lot of art handlers in other museums, many other museums, auction houses as well, they told me that they weren't trained to use forklifts or other machinery on the job, which is stuff you're supposed to be trained in.
It's like a thing you need to have a certification to drive and stuff.
Oh, yep. Looks.
And one art handler that talked to me at the new museum a couple of years ago, or maybe it was 1 year ago, actually got part of his finger torn off from a forklift because, by and large, art handlers are asked these days to work even faster with little breaks. People get fatigued. There was a veteran art handler at the Guggenheim who was sawing something and sawed his hand open because he was apparently so fatigued. So these injuries are happening. And, you know,
God, this is reminding me of so many stories. Yeah. I was just talking to some art handlers over the past couple of days, and like one of them was saying like there was this huge, huge tear because there was a delivery going from LA to New York, mm-hmm. and at some point in the middle, like the truck cut out of mm-hmm. communications, and everyone was like, where's the truck? Did we lose the art? Did we lose the people? The hell happened? Mm. They're like, oh no, all of the workers, not only the ones who are lifting and doing the on-site stuff, also are like falling asleep on the highway because they're doing trucker schedules where they're like, oh, mm-hmm. it's all right, I'm going to just be having the next 30 hours. Like,
but legally, they're not supposed to.
A shift.
No.
Legally, it's supposed to be 8 hours on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just.
It's crazy.
It's so bad mm-hmm. because it's like the labor movement will work and work to get all these regulations in place, and then there's a whole new industry pops up and makes all the same violations, and it's
not that new.
Yeah. That's the thing.
It's been just happening.
Or we'll grow. We'll grow a lot.
It's just dealing like with the ruling class directly. Mm. You're not able to hold anyone accountable because they're like, what? This isn't chill.
Well, the baton gets passed off too, so I think along with that the issue is burnout, right? Every art, the reason why you don't report something mm-hmm. is because you're like, oh, I'm done with that stressful situation, I want to move on, which is very fair, you know, you should be allowed to move on, but you're incentivized through the system that we have today to not report, which means that someone else is going to be experiencing the same thing that you did.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. And that's bad. Yeah. That's bad for the industry as a whole, but I think that's part of it. But before you mention trucks, so I wanted to tell a story that would knock your socks off.
Yay!
Oh my God.
No more socks.
So, no, it's going to be depressing and dark.
Oh, I want to hear it.
This room might be very smelly without the socks. It's a little hot. But anyway, so trucks. So let me take you to Washington, D.C., where I talked to a couple art handlers, you know, working with Smithsonian. So we're talking about like national heritage, national treasure sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So one art handler I talked to. So first of all, Smithsonian contracts a lot of their art handlers out so that they don't have to pay federal wages, mm-hmm. which honestly, like kind of understandable because the art handlers they do have on staff make like, you know, one guy I talked to is making, I think, $84,000 in salary.
Oh, wow.
As an art handler.
Pretty good.
Like exhibition
specialist. Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
I was talking to some friends at the Cooper Hewitt, mm-hmm. and they were saying that like the Smithsonian in general, like mm-hmm. the whole complex has a really weird structure because the museums that are in D.C. are way better funded and regulated in most cases mm-hmm. than this sort of like the stepchild of the Cooper Hewitt, which only has one HR person and apparently is creating a lot of issues themselves, and there's the whole
watches the Watchmen.
Well, in the museum world, you're not really trained for HR. But anyway, back to DC, back to trucks.
Yes.
So this art handler I talked to, like really early in his career, was working with this company that contracts with Smithsonian. So they get a call up, hey, we need you to go to the National Archives and get this vitrine, and we're going to transport it to New York. And it's like, okay, cool. Let me go to the National Archives. With the truck, they get the vitrine and they're like, oh, are there any artifacts on board? And the museum's like, no, like there's not. Like, okay. So a thing to know here with the Smithsonian, with like these really important cultural heritage objects, usually they will not tell the art handlers who are transporting the objects what is actually on the truck. And sometimes the trucks will come with armed security guards to protect said valuable object. You just won't know what's in there. Which is like, okay, you don't want someone stealing it. Like, we've all seen Ocean's 11.
Sure.
Gotcha.
Jules.
But the problem is, so they are on this ride to New York with this vitrine in the truck. They stop at a Wawa, which is like a convenience store on the highway, if you don't know.
Oh, that's so New Jersey. Yo.
And get some snacks. And this art handler gets a big Mountain Dew, like gulp-sized Mountain Dew. And so they get back in the truck, it's stationary, and you know, it's like passenger compartment, like things get bumped. So someone bumps the Mountain Dew, it spills near this laptop bag. And so this art handler I talked to was like, oh no, like there must be a laptop in there, like dives to save the laptop bag, gets it before the Mountain Dew hits it, opens the bag and realizes this is not a laptop bag. This is a specialty document case. And inside the case is the Emancipation Proclamation signed by Lincoln.
Yo!
Yo!
Yeah. Yay!
So that's the final story in the Art Handler saga, which...
Yay! That's so insane.
Right. So it's this idea...
Did it get Mountain Dew on it?
No.
Oh,
I wish it did. That's so American.
And I would have... Right. Yeah, I know. It would
and
really...
I used it to wipe off my barbecue.
Right. But it's this crazy idea that even... First of all, like, he was getting paid... $13 or $16 an hour at that time. So you have someone handling one of the most important documents in American history, getting paid no money, doesn't know what's on there. And then you have a situation like this where we almost lost the Emancipation Proclamation to Mountain Dew.
Oh, okay, wait, why is it in a laptop bag? Why isn't it in like a specialty like plastic?
No.
No, they just thought it was a laptop bag.
They thought it was a laptop bag because they didn't know what it was because they were told that there were no artifacts on the truck.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's wild. It's really, really wild what I've come across. I will see what happens with it if they change any of these policies. But I think that there is a big issue, again, coming back to the labor stuff, where, like, you have people working these long hours, getting injured, not getting paid, and they're handling artifacts, if not of national value, of global value. And... I don't know. What do you do with that if you can't pay someone properly to handle that? And it is expensive, though. Shipping, these companies, I found out, are worth tens of millions of dollars that do art handling professionally. Yikes. Yeah. Yikes. That's all I have to say.
I mean, but like, I'm thinking of like a weird like trolley problem where I'm like, who cares about the Declaration of Independence if it means somebody's going to be killed? Or like, I mean, like, would I take a bullet for the Declaration? I would not.
A lot of people would.
Well, then they should be getting paid secret security.
Secret Service. Secret Service should be handling art.
They should have an art handler.
Yeah.
Or they should be getting that level of wage, is all I'm saying.
Well, I think for me hearing that story too, I was like, well, the Smithsonian does have some of its own art handlers or exhibition specialists, as they're usually called. Maybe it would be better if they handled this instead of someone that's getting paid $13 an hour and doesn't know what it is.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably talk about that forever, but it comes back to this question of like what...
Here's what I would do. You
know? But then they don't want to drive the truck 30 hours, so...
Right. I mean, listen, I think art handling is a really hard job. I think that... people today are realizing that painfully aware of it. As you two are, you know, trying to create community around art and labor, Art Handler Magazine is another one that's doing this, and it's great Instagram page. I recommend you follow it.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, I definitely already do. It's awesome.
Big fans.
Clinton Lowry, who runs it, is great. And it's, you know, just... if you can establish a sense of community, you can establish a sense of pride in your work. And I think that's what leads people to actually talk about issues in the workforce. And that's what I think the art industry really needs right now, is for people to discuss how we make this world a better place.
Yeah, right? Definitely. I think that it's been a really heartening experience, especially just... you know, following along with these exposés about all of the wealth and all of the kind of exploitation that has been going on, that we're making it clear that there's a lot of importance here, and our positions are as meaningful as any, not only any other kind of communication, but any other kind of labor. And like, we're making culture, we are making the world, and we deserve not to be abused for that.
Right.
And yeah, I think there's also a lot of like you know, Zachary, you're mentioning like the sort of the earnestness and the kind of like emotional tie and the responsibility to these artifacts. Like, it's something that I think is, it's, I don't know, I believe in it. Like, I believe in the experiences that I've had in museums, and I know that I've been the one to say, like, yeah, like I've cried in museums. Like it's very emotional for me to like encounter. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your truth.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Like I'm a powder puff. I've cried in museums because I've been like overcome with beauty, and that's the hit that I want everyone to be able to access.
Right.
And like, yeah, being able to know that history is tangible and that there is such a lineage of like fighting and developing what freedom and liberty could
and,
mean.
And I think we should tie it with a pride of public service. Like I've come from libraries and stuff, and like that, it feels really good to like be the keeper of these things that are shared by a whole community. Mm-hmm. And like that's something that carries in with a lot of like, you know, when you're working, when you're taking care of these art objects too, and it's like,
right,
it's for the public, this is for everybody. And like, that's like something that you should take a lot of pride in.
Well, the question I would leave your listeners with is, you know, how can we as an arts community become more creative and think of more imaginative ways to structure our industry and structure our work lives?
Yeah.
I love it.
It's true.
Wow. Wow. So, yeah, in closing, I guess everybody check out Hyperallergic. Is there a title that they should be looking out for?
Yes. So the overall series is called Stories from Storage, The Danger Epidemic in Art Handling.
Awesome. Yeah. Yep. And
each section will be titled something different, but I'm sure Art Handler will be in the title, so you'll find it.
Right. And is there some place that people can follow you?
Yes, please do. Please follow my very low-key, low-attended Twitter at Zachary H. Small. And you can also follow me on my better, sassier Instagram at Zachary H. Small.
Nice.
Oh, that's awesome. We'll definitely link to you in our show notes. We'll link to the pieces in our show notes. Like I've said, we have linked to you, but like multiple times before.
I love it. Thank you. Keep on linking, please.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You've got a body of work. You've been on this beat like for a really long time, and not just us, like people all over the place who are like trying to figure out these questions have been following, and it's like really cool to talk to you, and thanks for coming on.
Oh, yeah, of course. Anytime.
Please support our Patreon. If you don't already, it helps us live and eat. And
we've been having a time of it.
It's tough.
We were on Drip, and Drip officially shutting down in October. So everyone who was on our Drip, just know that you.
Drip is being dropped.
Yeah, the drips are dropping, and that means your accounts will not be charged anymore, don't worry, nothing is going to get lost in the wash or whatever. But yeah, we're trying to switch over to Patreon, and it means a lot to continue making this show, especially for people who are stuck doing manual labor, and who just need, like, a hit to listen to something that is not their company culture.
I know that helped me when I was packing issues for Art Form, and I hope it's helping the packers who are still there.
Yeah, helps me on my jobs too.
All right, everyone, take care. Bye.
Hey, what's up, fun? I care if you have an aeroplane that can fly the world and we can have a fantasy. It doesn't really matter if you drive a limousine. It really doesn't matter if you drive for galaxy. I don't care if you just drive a truck. I don't care if you just drive a limousine. It doesn't really matter if you drive a Ferrari. I really don't care, cause I just love your company. Let's have fun. 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 Lots of fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun, lots of fun.